Hello, everyone. Welcome to the ADEM Academy podcast series. This is the first podcast in an ongoing series about ADEM, or acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. This podcast is titled Pediatric and Adolescent ADEM. My name is Gigi DeFebri from the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and I will be co-moderating this podcast along with Peter Fontanez from the MOG Project. Peter, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, yes, my name is Peter Fontanez. I'm with the MOG Project, and my daughter, Isabel Fontanez, is a ADEM and MOG AD patient as well.
Great. So SRNA and the MOG Project are collaborating on this podcast series. We're both nonprofits that are focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders, including ADEM and MOG antibody disease. You can learn more about us on our websites, which are wearesrna.org. and mogproject.org.
For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Jonathan Santoro. Dr. Santoro serves as the Director of Neuroimmunology and Demyelinating Disorders Programs at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. He is also an Assistant Professor of Neurology and Pediatrics at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Dr. Santoro completed his undergraduate, master's, and medical degrees at Tulane University. He subsequently completed residencies in pediatrics and child neurology at the Stanford University School of Medicine and subsequently had subspecialty training in neuroimmunology and pediatric multiple sclerosis at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Santoro is a passionate NIH fund physician scientist who has published over 70 peer-reviewed manuscripts. His clinical and research focus is endocrine dysregulation and pediatric onset multiple sclerosis and the neuroimmunology of Down syndrome. He currently serves on the American Academy of Neurology's Health Policy Subcommittee and chairs the Advanced Drug Monitoring Task Force. Dr. Santoro is a longstanding advocate for persons with disability and has lobbied locally in California and on Capitol Hill. Welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me. This is such an exciting topic and such an exciting opportunity to work with both organizations on kind of putting the word out about ADEM to families that need this information. So very excited to be here.
Well, let's start off with our first question. The first topic we're going to be discussing is diagnosis. With the discovery of the MOG antibody, aquaporin 4 antibody, NMDA antibody, and other antibodies, walk us through the diagnosis process for ADEM, considering other potential causes and differential diagnoses.
Yeah, this is a really important question. I think that ADEM can look different in every patient. And I think that if you talk to enough people in these, you know, advocacy groups and rare disease societies, you realize that nobody shows up with the same symptoms. And I think that historically, ADEM was kind of a, you know, all-encompassing diagnosis, right? The radiographic or the MRI features were kind of more broad. The clinical features could include kind of anything, including encephalopathy for the main symptom. But in the age of antibodies, where we've discovered all of these different causes for these symptoms, it's actually allowed us to be a little bit more specific, but ultimately the diagnosis is still one that is clinical and then paired up with the radiographic or MRI features in many cases. So although we have more information and we have more tests to do that help us differentiate potential causes and ultimately prognosis and need for monitoring, the diagnosis is still what it was many years ago.
Got it. And are there any special considerations when diagnosing ADEM in children and pediatrics rather than in adults? Or is that diagnostic process kind of similar?
Yeah, so I think this is a really interesting question in that, you know, we know ADEM is diagnosed more in children, but it's not a, you know, entirely rare entity in adults either. I think that when we look at children, and of course, I'm a pediatric neurologist by training, we think of it more as kind of this herald event, which was really thought to be monophasic for many, many years. And now we've discovered that with MOG antibodies, there is a percentage of patients that go on to have relapsing or multiple episodes of either ADEM or other demyelinating disease. And in addition, we found that children who have these initial attacks of ADEM sometimes actually go on to develop other demyelinating diseases like multiple sclerosis that we didn't think were necessarily related to one another. In adults, the secondary causes of ADEM seem to be a little bit more common. Obviously, you still see some MOG antibody disease in that population as well, but toxic, metabolic, chemotherapeutic causes and infectious causes are a little bit more prevalent in that population and probably are more of a diagnosis of exclusion in adults, whereas it's a little bit more inclusive and important to monitor over time in younger patients.
When diagnosing ADEM, is a lumbar puncture necessary? If not, when is this used?
Yeah, this is one that comes up all the time. So really, if we just go by the criteria, no, it is not necessary, right? So the clinical features and then the MRI features are really what help us make the diagnosis of ADEM. I think that in the days now where we can actually test for many of these antibodies in both the blood and the cerebrospinal fluid, and given the importance of ruling out mimics of ADEM, we normally recommend that all patients will go on to get a lumbar puncture, but it is not critically necessary for the diagnosis of the condition. But right, I think that when you have infection of the central nervous system or the brain on the differential diagnosis and a lot of other kind of rare and unusual metabolic or genetic mimics of the condition, especially in children, it's really important to have that data to support the diagnosis as well. So while we have these diagnostic criteria, we want as much information as possible to feel really comfortable and confident in making the diagnosis as well.
Great. And so you talked about clinical presentation and MRI. What is the clinical presentation of ADEM? And then also, what do you look for on MRI that's kind of characteristic of ADEM?
Yeah, so the number one thing that you need is encephalopathy or a change in mental status, people not thinking or being able to cognitively be the same. I think that's kind of the core feature of ADEM. After that, it's, you know, just like in real estate, it's location, 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 right? So where your inflammation is in the brain actually determines what symptoms you are likely to have. So for instance, if you have involvement of the optic nerve, vision may be the issue. If you have inflammation in the spinal cord, gait or walking may be impaired. If you have inflammation in the cerebellum, the back part of the brain, it may be coordination. But really, it is highly variable. All things can be present, or only a few things can be present. And I think that this just kind of goes to what we were saying, you know, earlier, is that, you know, every presentation of ADEM looks a little bit different. But, you know, really, the encephalopathy is the key piece, and then everything else is very dependent on the location of the inflammation.
And then in terms of the MRI, are there particular patterns you're looking for, or are you just looking for inflammation in these kind of areas?
Yeah, so the radiographic features are that you have involvement on both sides of the brain. And again, we think of inflammation as not really restricted to one side or the other. The lesions tend to be very broad, confluent, larger than some of the other lesions that we would see in things like multiple sclerosis, neuromyelitis optica, things of that nature. And then we kind of pair those up with the clinical features. So if the clinical features seem to match and the radiographic features seem to match, that's where we're kind of feeling most confident about arriving at the diagnosis of ADEM.
On that note, you're speaking about clinical features matching up with MRI features and things like that. Can a patient present with symptoms consistent with ADEM yet not initially show on the MRI? If so, what actions should healthcare professionals take in this case, including patients' follow-up or additional MRI?
Yeah, this is a great question, Peter. So yes and no, right? So the criteria really require that MRI feature, but what we know is that no test is 100% sensitive, right? And so in these, you know, situations where the imaging comes back negative, but some of the features or many of the clinical features match, it's really important to just repeat an MRI. I think that we've been surprised, right, when we have patients that have all of these symptoms, but then we get the MRI and there's nothing there. Sometimes it just takes a little bit of time to actually develop those features on the neuroimaging. So there have been many cases and, you know, many cases that we've seen over the last few years where we get the MRI early and now we can get MRIs almost instantly when patients come into the hospital. And the imaging features may not be as striking right up front, but a few days later, then they actually start to emerge and evolve into what we would normally expect.
And then speaking about MRI, so for adults, you can tell adults to get in the machine and stay still. Are there particular recommendations for sedation, or really what are those recommendations for small children who need to get imaging?
Yeah, and I think this is a complicated issue, right? Because we're talking about what's the risk, what's the benefit. The risk of being sedated is there, and it's something to always talk about with the anesthesiologist. There's no sedation that is risk-free. But we have to weigh that against, you know, having a confirmatory diagnosis and making sure that we're not missing another mimic that could kind of look like ADEM clinically, but maybe doesn't have those neuroimaging features. So I still think it's generally suggested that we go through with the sedation. And thankfully, at many pediatric hospitals, we have people who are not just trained in pediatrics and anesthesiology, but specifically pediatric anesthesiology. So while there's no certainty that there is no risk, you know, it's generally very important to have that piece of data to make the diagnosis. Although I will say the youngest patient we have ever been able to get in the scanner without sedation is about 5. So it can be done. It's certainly the outlier in the situation, but we always want to weigh risk and benefits with any intervention that we do.
On that note, I know this one affects everybody personally because we've all gone through this with these diagnoses. What are some of the diagnostic challenges that some parents and healthcare providers face? And what are some of the ways that they can overcome these challenges?
Yeah, I think number one is being a well-informed parent, right? I think that ADEM is a surprise diagnosis for many people. I don't think that anyone kind of goes into the hospital thinking that this is what is going on with my child. So becoming rapidly informed is always kind of the best way to get up to speed and be able to communicate with your physicians, your care team, everybody. I think that because ADEM and many, many demyelinating disorders can look so different in each person, it's a challenge because there's not one feature that I would say, oh yeah, you definitely need to be evaluated for, you know, a demyelinating disease. These conditions are extraordinarily rare, as many people listening to this podcast have probably figured out. And so really what I look at as a physician is, how confident am I in this decision? Conversely, how confident am I that this is something else, right? And this is where all of these diagnostic tests can be really linked in together to help fit that puzzle piece. So if the clinical features don't fit, the MRI doesn't fit, can I use something like a lumbar puncture, spinal tap? Can I use an EEG? Can I use blood testing, genetic testing to make sure that we're arriving at the right test so that I can start the right treatments?
Great. And then who typically does this diagnostic process? Is it in the emergency room? Is it neurologists? Do you mind just talking a little bit about kind of who on the team is involved in that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for individuals who are coming in for the first time, it's usually through the emergency room. Most of the time, the pediatric neurologists are going to be involved pretty early on in the diagnostic journey. But every hospital system is a little bit different. I mean, there are definitely hospitals out in the, you know, in the more rural and suburban areas of the country that don't have a pediatric neurologist available. And you may be worked up by a pediatrician who's trained in hospital medicine. So it depends on each institution. But what we always recommend is once the diagnosis has been made, to reach out to somebody with specialty training in neuroimmunology and specifically pediatric neuroimmunology, if that's available as well.
Are there any other diagnostic criteria or testing that a patient can expect when trying to figure out this diagnosis? I know we talked about MRI and antibody testing, but is there anything else that a patient can expect to have?
Yeah, I think that those are the big two. I think that lumbar puncture, the spinal tap, is also on there for most patients. You know, ADEM can be associated with seizures. So often individuals who come in through the hospital will get an EEG as well. And then, you know, in addition, we've kind of added on additional blood testing over the years. And again, it's a rule out diagnosis. So it will depend on what you show up with. But a lot of the time, you know, the expectation would be at least an MRI and blood work, but very likely lumbar puncture and potentially an EEG too if the symptoms fit.
I just had a question. So we sometimes hear from people that they have inflammation in the spinal cord or an inflammation in the optic nerve. And they say, you know, I have transverse myelitis, optic neuritis, and acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. Is that how it actually is? Is this a terminology kind of debate? Just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Technically, that's not incorrect, right? So really what we're describing is that there's inflammation in these specific parts of the brain, right? Optic neuritis just means inflammation of the optic nerve, transverse inflammation of the spinal cord. When we talk about ADEM, I think what we've focused so much on for so long was that the encephalopathy piece. And it's very likely we were missing a lot of optic neuritis or transverse myelitis that was happening at the same time. So I think that, you know, because we've become better about evaluating it in the hospital and certainly in the outpatient clinics, you know, you can say ADEM and have it be all encompassing. But I think that what is most helpful for me when we evaluate new patients is to know exactly the prior areas that were affected, because there is, you know, importance for prognostication, likelihood of MOG antibodies, and then certainly, you know, what is the monitoring that is going to be needed for these patients long term. So I tend to be on the side of tell me more than tell me less.
We're going to go ahead and move on to our next topic, which is treatments. What is the typical treatment for a patient dealing with an active attack?
Yeah, so when patients come in and the diagnosis is made, most patients are going to receive 3 to 5 days of IV steroids right off the bat. Other therapies that kind of emerge after that are IVIG and sometimes plasmapheresis. And certainly in refractory cases, you may be seeing more targeted biologics or other anti-inflammatory medications. I think, you know, a big challenge in ADEM is there's not ever really been a randomized controlled clinical trial about what the best therapy is. So while we stick to the dogma of steroids first and IVIG or potentially plasmapheresis afterwards, there's a lot of variability hospital to hospital, region to region. And I think that that's certainly an area that, you know, hopefully will be addressed by some larger scale studies in the near future. But, you know, as we know, ADEM, MOG antibodies, they're rare. And so trying to put together a standardized clinical trial for this sort of stuff is a staggering task in spite of the need for it.
And does the acute treatment differ based on whether someone is MOG positive or not? If they aren't, is that acute treatment still the same?
Yeah, for the acute treatment, not too much. What we do know is that individuals with MOG antibodies tend to be more responsive to steroids. So often what we kind of train our residents and fellows on is to say that, you know, with a MOG-associated ADEM, the symptoms should melt away. They should be very quick to resolve, whereas in non-ADEM-associated causes, it may be a little bit more challenging or require the other therapies. But I think many of the neuroimmunologists out there have certainly seen exceptions to that rule where the MOG antibody was found later and they didn't have that classic, you know, melt away response to the steroids. So it varies, but I think that this is the challenge is, you know, we know that the MOG antibody is out there, but are there other blood-based biomarkers that we're still missing that could be helpful for determining who's going to respond to what therapy?
Got it. And so moving beyond kind of that acute phase in terms of preventive treatments, should a patient be on preventive treatment? And if so, what treatments are recommended? And does this depend on the cause of the ADEM?
Yeah, so this is a really important question, and I wish I could give you a more specific answer, but it's very unclear still. So I think that, again, ADEM was thought to be monophasic for many, many patients, but now we're finding that there's relapsing associated ADEM. There's ADEM with MOG antibodies that evolves to other conditions like optic neuritis, transverse myelitis, or neuromyelitis optica. And there's other patients who develop ADEM who go on to develop multiple sclerosis. And I think that we've kind of gone back and forth on a community for prevention versus waiting for a second attack before starting patients on it. But I think the jury's still out. And I think that this is another example of there are regional difference, hospital-hospital differences, but we don't have strong data to support preventative therapy at this time.
I know that certain conditions like MS, NMO, aquaporin 4, MOG antibody disease can have issues with specific treatments that they may not be as reactive to. Because we talked about ones that are reactive, but now for those that aren't reactive, are there any treatments that should be avoided depending on the cause of ADEM? Example, like MOG antibody, aquaporin 4, or like you were saying, MS, is there any treatments that should be avoided?
Yeah, so I think that this is really hard in the acute period where you're not necessarily sure which direction to go. For ADEM and MOG antibody syndromes, we use very broad immunotherapy. So it's rare that we're using something so targeted that we're going to cause additional problems. But I think as we've seen in individuals with neuromyelitis optica, when we've treated them, these patients who have aquaporin 4 mediated disease, they go much worse when we gave them MS therapies in spite of the fact that they were very broad MS therapeutics. So I think we it's something that we need to explore a little bit more to see what works and what doesn't. But in the same breath, we haven't really had a lot of experience using targeted biologics or even MS medications in individuals with ADEM or MOG antibody syndromes. But it's certainly on the horizon and an area where we need to kind of pivot and investigate a little bit.
For treatments, so we talked about acute, like patients that are going through acute attacks that are and treatments for that. But for long-term preventative, What are some options that a patient may be able to be on for preventative treatments long-term?
Yeah. So, you know, in individuals who have had more than one relapse and are associated, let's say, with MOG antibodies, you know, I think an important, you know, the best data thus far has been, you know, IVIG or intravenous immunoglobulin, mycophenolate mofetil, and then rituximab have been kind of the big three that have been used the most in the literature. You know, for individuals that go on to develop kind of subsets that aren't associated with MOG antibodies, I think that that is a little bit less clear. And individuals certainly who go on from ADEM to develop multiple sclerosis, it's a whole different therapeutic class. But I think that for at least from MOG antibody associated disease prevention, those have been the big three that we've had the most success with. And I think it depends on the patient who gets what, right? So IV therapies are a bear. And especially if you're a younger patient, going and getting pricked once a month can be a lot. So we've had, you know, success with using high-dose mycophenolate. We've had success with using rituximab, and we've certainly had success with administering IVIG, but nothing to say one is superior to the other. So there, again, a lot of regional differences with this one.
And relatedly, so you mentioned how, you know, getting IVs for small children can be difficult. Do you find that treatments kind of change over time as children get older, or does it typically stay the same?
Yeah, I mean, we keep that open dialogue with patients. And I think that certainly for some of our older preteens or teenagers, they have opinions. And it would be silly for us as physicians and neuroimmunologists to ignore those, right? So if a patient comes in and says, I don't want to do IV therapy anymore, that's fine. We're going to have to find something else though, all right? Or similar, if they say, you know what, I can't tolerate this mycophenolate because it's making my stomach upset and I, you know, have all these other side effects, then we have to consider using something else too. I think that during the pandemic, there was a lot of concern about infection as well. And so many patients were preferring to be on IVIG, knowing that that is an immune boosting medicine in most circumstances, as opposed to immune suppressing like the other two.
With that, you were talking about IV access, and I know, you know, being a caretaker of a child who had to have IV access monthly, I know it can be very burdensome. Now, with that, very difficult. What are your options between, or what are your thoughts regarding IV access on a child versus a port? Because I know a lot of patients have gone through that in the community. And when do you feel the need to switch over from IV access to a port? Like how long that time frame when you think, okay, that would be too long, let's switch it over?
Yeah, and I think that this is a tough and very personal decision for families. So a port is a central access point that is right under the skin that basically you don't have to prick an IV anymore. You're just going to stick the needle right into this kind of, you know, plastic piece that's under the skin over the chest to access. So it's a lot easier for, especially for young patients, certainly less traumatic than kind of going through and trying to find a vein. Ultimately, there's not a magic number though, right? So, you know, for us, at least at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, we kind of say if we're going to continue therapy on over a year, then it certainly should be discussed and at least be evaluated. But, you know, there are some families we've spoken to, they said there's under no circumstances would we go through with this. And then other families are asking me at the very first visit because they have a traumatic IV placement. So I think it's something to definitely bring up with your doctor, especially if it's looking like it's going to be more than, you know, more than a few infusions moving forward. You know, I think that many of us as physicians is we don't want to do something that we can't, you know, easily track out of, right? So if we're going to change the therapy and IVIG is now off the table, then having a port in as physicians, we're like, oh, we should have never put that in, right? So I think it's something to bring up early. And certainly, you know, it's going to be a case-by-case discussion with your doctor.
Great. And then we did get a question from someone listening about the difference between a neurologist and a neuroimmunologist. Are these the same or different?
Yeah, great question. So all neuroimmunologists are also neurologists, but not all neurologists are neuroimmunologists. So the way to think about it is it's the specialty that really only is dealing with ADEM, MOG, autoimmune encephalitis, optic neuritis, transverse myelitis. That's what we do day in and day out. So we have a ability to remain up to date on the literature. We're participating in the clinical trials, the natural history studies. But a neurologist in many situations is going to be up to speed on MOG, is going to know the basics of the treatment, and can certainly reach out for assistance. Not every center has a pediatric trained neuroimmunologist. And I think that that's something where, as a community, we try to be as collaborative as possible. We're always answering emails, getting on the phone with people, but, you know, it just may not be, you know, possible in some circumstances, and that's totally okay.
So do you mind, we're going to move on past that, you know, the treatment phase, acute phase, and talk a little bit about outcomes and kind of the long-term care. So do you mind just talking, you talked about monophasic ADEM and how that was kind of what we thought ADEM was for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about monophasic ADEM versus multiphasic ADEM and what that means?
Yeah, so I think the name kind of tells you right off the bat, right? So monophasic, meaning it happens once and you're done. Relapsing or multiphasic ADEM, meaning it's happening more than once. You know, it's interesting because for many years with monophasic ADEM, we labeled somebody as a patient as having ADEM, and then we said, okay, call us if you need us, right? And so we didn't know if those patients were actually relapsing for the longest time, or they would, you know, have another attack, but now it was optic neuritis. And we weren't really drawing that connection between the ADEM, optic neuritis, transverse lyonitis, whatever the next attack would be. I think that, you know, now because we're following patients in neuroimmunology clinics, we have this natural history that's become very robust. And we know that certain antibodies, for instance, MOG, are more likely to be associated with those relapsing courses. I think that we're monitoring and actually identifying that relapses, whether they're multiphasic ADEM, meaning ADEM that happens more than one time, or ADEM that transforms into optic neuritis, transverse myelitis, neuromyelitis optica, is much more common than we originally thought.
As you were talking about how it transitions to with optic neuritis, so I know that there was also, I don't know if this is still considered a diagnosis, but it used to be one of the other ones. There was ADEM, monophasic ADEM, recurrent ADEM, and multiphasic ADEM. Is recurrent ADEM still a thing, or is that something that has been phased out since?
Yeah, it's you can never really phase out the terminology. I think it's certainly probably come more under the umbrella of the multiphasic ADEM. So we use terms interchangeably when there is a second attack. But I think that, you know, many of these terms are kind of arbitrary as well, right? Like even for, you know, ADEM, when you have an attack that is very closely associated with the original attack, we didn't know for the longest time whether to say that, all right, all of this is part of the original attack, or actually these are two discrete events. So, you know, if you put 10 neurologists in a room, you're going to get 10 different answers on how it should be named and what should constitute it. But I think for all intents and purposes, we're kind of putting them under the same umbrella right now.
Is there a difference between multiphasic and recurrent ADEM, or because you're talking about using them interchangeably, but is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for historically, we kind of thought as the recurrent form as like the exact same process happening again, like the same symptoms were kind of coming back. Whereas multiphasic, I think, kind of helps identify that there is not just a different point in time that this is occurring, but their symptoms may be different, even though they're meeting criteria for ADEM at that time. So again, it's a little bit of more jargon than anything. I think that, you know, any neurologist and any parent who is looking at the patient is going to go, okay, well, this is, you know, recurrent or multiphasic ADEM, whereas the exact terminology doesn't impart as much understanding about what the disease process is.
Got it. And so you talked about an onset. If someone has, for example, inflammation in the spinal cord, they might have issues with gait. If they have visual issues for optic nerve inflammation. So what might be the kind of outcomes or long-term impacts of an initial ADEM attack?
Yeah. So for most patients who develop ADEM, the outcomes are generally excellent. Now, that depends on antibodies, it depends on response to treatment, and it depends on the location of the inflammation as well. So what we know, for instance, is that if you have optic neuritis as part of your ADEM, and it's MOG antibody responsive, generally the visual outcomes are quite good. Whereas if you have optic neuritis without the MOG antibodies, you can expect to have some impact on it. But again, there's always exceptions to the rule. What we've found most is whether it's monophasic or relapsing, there have been long-term neurocognitive outcomes associated with ADEM. And that includes things like ADHD, impulse control, behavioral disturbances that many of us have kind of observed very subtly, but maybe don't actually carry that diagnosis. It's another important thing to bring up. But then, you know, again, like other things are much more obvious. So recovering from transverse myelitis, you may be left with permanent, you know, gait issues or walking issues, or have a long protracted rehabilitation course. So it really just depends on where those insults are, which is why it's so important to be able to recognize it quickly and treat it quickly as well.
Got it. And so you mentioned these kind of long-term symptoms. Is it also possible to have seizures or additional kind of behavioral or cognitive issues too?
Yeah. So the neurocognitive issues are really interesting because we've phenotyped them very poorly. You know, most neurologists, especially neuroimmunologists, are so focused on ADEM, so focused on MOG antibodies that we're kind of glazing over some of the behavioral issues that emerge in school. So again, ADHD, impulse control, sensory processing issues come up quite a bit. We've had a few patients who have had ADEM very, very early, who have kind of high functioning autism later on. And again, it's not that they are developing autism because of the ADEM, but there is something about this process that is affecting brain development that may be associated with this. Seizures are very interesting. If you have seizures up front, you are likely or at an increased risk of having epilepsy in the long term. What we've observed so far, and our group is looking to actually publish some of this data, is that with MOG antibodies, if you have seizures up front, you go through this quiescent period for usually a year or two, and then are developing epilepsy on the back end of it. And it's often not associated with the MOG antibodies, meaning that there's been some injury to different parts of the brain that are creating epileptic foci or areas where seizures come from, just from the nature of having an attack of ADEM, and specifically in this situation with MOG antibodies.
And then if a child is experiencing some of these behavioral or cognitive issues, do you typically refer them to see a neuropsychologist, or kind of who manages those sort of issues?
It depends on the symptoms. So I think that in general, we're always referring to neuropsychology because it allows us to get a baseline. So few patients are going to have some type of assessment before their symptoms develop, that getting that immediate baseline and being able to track that longitudinally or over time is super helpful and can identify strengths and weaknesses of the individual, so that way they can be, you know, receiving extra help in the school system if they need it. Some patients need a psychologist, you know, that type of therapy, behavioral modification. Some patients need actual pharmacotherapy, so therapies for their ADHD or impulse control, which are often administered by a psychiatrist. But, you know, it's a multidisciplinary effort. So everybody is involved with the care of the same exact patient, but having that open discussion with your neuroimmunologist or your neurologist, who's usually the quarterback for the team, to help kind of point in which direction, you know, your child needs those resources can be very, very helpful. I think one of the hidden secrets is having an education specialist that you work with. Sometimes they're social workers, sometimes they're former teachers or have a background in educational advocacy. Those are all really important things to optimize educational outcomes in individuals who have this.
What are some of the signs and symptoms that a parent should look for during a possible ADEM relapse? Like example, what are some of the signs and symptoms for ADEM optic neuritis, or what are some of the signs and symptoms for multiphasic ADEM?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, it can look like anything, which makes it extra complicated for families and caregivers. So, you know, number one, if it's ADEM, there's going to be encephalopathy or that change in mental status again. You know, if there's optic neuritis, visual complaints, double vision can be a problem. Eye pain with movements can be a problem. Again, if it's more in the brain, it can be weakness. It can be sensory changes. If it's in the cerebellum, it can be gait abnormalities, ataxia, meaning it's difficult to point to objects. And certainly for the spinal cord, what we worry about is weakness, difficulty walking, and potentially even bowel or bladder syndromes. I think that that's one of the underscored things that we've found about MOG antibodies is it tends to hang out at the bottom of the spinal cord, which can cause something called a neurogenic bladder, meaning you can get all the urine out. So it can look like many different things, which makes it challenging. But I think that what we always tell families is if the mom, dad, aunt, grandma, grandpa radar is going off, that's enough for you to be contacting your neurologist and reaching out.
With that, we're going to take a question from the community. Are you seeing any patterns regarding which MOG positive ADEM patients relapse versus which ones don't?
You know, in the single digit age group, not necessarily. I think, you know, we've been basing it much more on the continued presence of the MOG antibodies more than anything. In the post puberty crowd, we found that optic neuritis has a much higher rate of relapse. Transverse myelitis has a higher rate of relapse. So we kind of stratify it more by age at the initial onset, less so than some of the core clinical features. But, you know, in the same breath, ADEM is much more common in the single digit age group than optic neuritis and transverse myelitis is in the older age group. So hard to make heads or tails of that.
And then is rehabilitation useful after an ADEM diagnosis? And if so, what types of rehabilitation should patients consider for the best outcome? So the occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, and does this vary on the potential lingering symptoms that someone might have?
Yeah, so, you know, early evaluation for therapy services is great if you're in the hospital setting. So, you know, some centers have inpatient rehabilitation, which is fantastic if you can access it. But, you know, it's going to depend on what the leftover symptoms are. So certainly if there's weakness or if there's coordination problems, physical therapy, occupational therapy can be fantastic and very helpful. For people who have had a dysphagia, difficulty swallowing, difficulty with language, or some of those cognitive complaints, speech therapy can be very helpful. And then we've had a number of patients that have gone on to inpatient rehabilitation for a week or two on the back end and really benefited from that. So, you know, in general, we always recommend it where it's available. And it's one of those few things as a doctor, I can prescribe therapy and it's not going to harm the patient. There's no side effect of getting those extra therapies, extra support, whether it's on the inpatient side or the outpatient side.
Dr. Santoro, on a follow-up to one of the questions you just answered about what are some of the symptoms that a patient, parent should look for. You mentioned all these symptoms. Like you said, ADEM can look like just about anything depending on where the attack is occurring. Where I know that there's also pseudo relapses as well as like things like Yule-Tov phenomenon, which can trigger things that seem like relapses. At what point should a parent or a caretaker, time frame wise, like if a patient has a headache, obviously you don't want to call the doctor for 5 minutes of a headache, but if they have a headache last or they're having mobility issues for a whole day, like what is the time frame that you're talking about these neurological symptoms? Because obviously with pseudo relapses and Yule-Tov phenomenon, you know, where do we draw the line that okay, this may be a new neurological attack versus just a small side speed bump?
Yeah, no, this is a fantastic question. So three important things. The first thing is if your concern radar is going off, just contact your doctor, right? If your gut is telling you that something is wrong, just call, just show up. It's nobody's ever going to fault you for being overly concerned. For recrudescence or the kind of Yule-Tov phenomenon or pseudo relapse, those symptoms should generally look like what happened before, like exactly what happened before. And an important piece of this that you can think about as a caregiver is there some stressor on the body that could be allowing for this? Is your child sick? Are they sleep deprived? Are they stressed out? Is there something else going on that could help explain it? For instance, Yule-Tov phenomena is often seen when there's high heat and then all of a sudden it feels like a relapse is coming back. If you can pair it up with some type of temporal stressor and then removing that environmental or temporal stressor results in improvement of the symptoms, generally unlikely or less likely to be a relapse. But that other piece is, well what about the time frame? We all make up numbers. And let's be honest, as a neuroimmunologist, we kind of say 24 hours. If it's less than that, it's probably not anything serious. If it's longer than that, we definitely want to get the evaluation. But again, like always follow this in order, right? So rule one, if your gut's telling you something is wrong, then something is wrong. Number two, if it looks and you looks similar to what you had before and there's another explanation for it, you know, wait it out. And then the third is that magic 24-hour window. So if it's lasting too long, just call in and get evaluated.
With that, what are some of the effects that a pediatric ADEM can have on a child's education, such as like cognitive or behavioral issues in school and things of that nature?
Yeah, this is really important and something that we're realizing in real time. So now, while the prognosis neurologically is excellent for most patients who develop ADEM, school issues crop up a lot and they can be soft, right? So attention problems in school, impulse control issues, are not something that are usually getting flagged and are getting brought up to a neurologist. So, you know, always talking about it, getting that neuropsych assessment, and then finding the strengths and weaknesses on those neuropsych assessments so you can advocate for better resources within the school district, tutoring, or pharmacotherapy in some situations is really important. So we know that even a single attack of ADEM can cause these kind of augmented or different outcomes long-term. So I tend to favor the side of let's get the testing and see if we can help out with any needs. But thus far, we haven't found something that reverses that effect. But again, I'm hopeful that in the future, we're going to find that early identification, early treatment can actually benefit patients in the long-term.
On that, how do you distinguish, especially like a tween / teen child, how do you distinguish an ADEM or long-term cognitive behavioral issues versus just puberty that we deal with as parents? Because I know that's one of the difficulties I have with my child.
Yes, and an important one. And this is where I still thank myself that both of my children are under four still, and I don't have to deal with this. But, you know, I think it's a challenge, right? And I think that's where having that baseline testing is really important. Because if you get the baseline neuropsych, and it looks the same at 13 as it did at 10, then I think we feel a little bit more reassured and we can say, all right, this is probably more teenage stuff. Obviously, it's a little bit more challenging if the ADEM happens at the time when all of these changes are going on too. But I think that, you know, erring on the side of do we need to treat this or do we need to intervene or not is always important. But that's where the multidisciplinary care comes. As a neurologist, neuroimmunologist, I can tell you with confidence, I am not great at figuring out the nuances of ADHD and educational issues, but I need to ask for help. I need to ask for help from our neuropsychologists, from our psychiatrists to make sure that we're doing as much as we can for our individuals. But again, Peter, like having those baseline assessments makes it really easy to say like, this is something we need to worry about, or this is something that is just hormones and being a teen.
Great. We got some questions from some listeners. One said, why was ADEM discovered so long before MOG and how was it discovered?
Yeah, it's a really cool question. So, I mean, the discovery of it, just like with anything in neurology, is the phenotype. So if you go back, whether it's Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis, we describe as neurologists what we see. And so these presentations, as you all know, are very dramatic in children. The encephalopathy, the other neurologic deficits that show up, the seizures that can be present, it's not a very subtle thing that, you know, springs up. So the initial reports were just descriptions of what was going on. The funny thing is that when MRI came around, it was still very difficult to obtain. So we didn't have great radiographic description of ADEM until kind of the 80s and 90s. And once we emerged from there, we started pairing up like, this is the clinical piece. This is the radiographic piece. This seems to be what ADEM is. But I think that, you know, from the get-go, ADEM encompassed many, many different things. And it was encompassing MOG. It was encompassing, you know, other demyelinating conditions. And only now have we been able to differentiate it. You know, the MOG antibody has been known about for 40 years. It's just we never put two and two together and understood that this was pathologic because in our basic science experiments, it didn't seem to be causative of the type of demyelination that we observe in individuals who have ADEM. And I think that some of this is because the animal model, so the way that protein is expressed from MOG in mouse and rodent or rat models is different and causes different symptoms and different radiographic patterns in humans. And that kind of held us up a little bit, but ultimately, you know, it took us a while, but we got there. And I think that it's really revolutionized how we look at this condition in children and adults.
On that, Dr. Santoro, you've answered these questions have been incredible. Thank you so much for your time. We wanted to ask you some final thoughts on ADEM, the direction ADEM. I know this is going to be like a long, dragged out question, but your final thoughts on ADEM, the direction you see it going in. Is there any research you currently see that's coming up or ongoing for pediatrics and just ADEM patients in general? And anything in particular that you're working on for neuroimmune diseases? Because I know you're heading up a lot of incredible things right now. You know, give us some information on some of the nuances, the things that are coming up around the corner that you are working on and with ADEM in general.
Yeah, I think that it's an exciting time to be a neurologist in research here. So we're learning so much more about what this condition looks like over time. We're learning very quickly who we need to treat and who we don't need to treat. And I think that the finding something that is both specific and effective for the treatment of MOG-ADEM, non-MOG-ADEM, and all of these other different phenotypes that can emerge from there is becoming increasingly important. So, you know, I think it's, as a young neurologist, and you guys can't see my gray hair, but it is starting to crop up in my on the side of my head. You know, it's such a cool time because I'm able to collaborate with people who are very senior and have done this type of research in multiple sclerosis, you know, already, who've done it in neuromyelitis optica and aquaporin 4 disease. So I feel like, if anything, ADEM and MOG-associated demyelinating conditions are probably on the fast track for actually having breakthrough immunologic developments because we can apply what we've already learned in other conditions over. You know, for us, what we've pivoted to is looking at the common genetic links for many of these conditions. And in a paper we published with one of our fellows just over the summer, we found that not just in MOG, but ADEM and then other demyelinating conditions, there seems to be common pathways that are explained from a genetic predisposition standpoint, which you know, could explain how these conditions not just, you know, evolve over time, but kind of mix and match. ADEM becomes MS in some situations, MOG stays as MOG, relapsing optic neuritis versus transverse myelitis versus going back and forth. I think we're finding that there's more similarity than difference at a very basic level, even though the phenotypes may look completely different. So exciting time, but there's gonna, you know, we still have work to do. And that's the thing is that, you know, while I feel like we've made a lot of progress, we still don't have a randomized clinical trial. We still don't know who to treat with preventative therapies versus waiting for a second attack. We still don't have something that is specific for ADEM. So we've got a lot of work to do, but it's an exciting time, and I'm very much looking forward to what the next decade is going to bring.
So with the clinical trials for MOG, what do you think it'll take for clinical trials for ADEM to launch? And are there kind of different considerations for a child, you know, that studies with children versus adults? This was a question we got from an audience.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about the MOG trials, but ultimately we can be more all-encompassing in MOG because there's different phenotypes that we can pull in, whereas ADEM is a little bit more narrow. It's a little bit more rare. Now, when we think about clinical trial design, as we mentioned, ADEM in children seems to be a little bit more homogenous and more likely to be demyelinating, whereas in adults, while we still see it, and it often is inflammatory, there can be other explanations for the ADEM too. So if I had to make a guess, I'd say we're probably closer to a pediatric ADEM study as opposed to an adult ADEM study, but both will be tremendously important. But, you know, I'm hopeful, but it's a little bit harder to recruit these very tiny populations as opposed to with MOG, where we can kind of pull in optic neuritis, pull in transverse myelitis, and pull in ADEM patients all in one breath.
We have one question from the Facebook community, as this is Facebook Live, and their question is, I got to read this because it's within a whole paragraph, so I got to find where I'm at. So she has recently been diagnosed with syringomyelia. Could there be anything to do with her having ADEM? A patient that was, I guess, recently diagnosed with syringomyelia. Is there any relation to that with ADEM?
Hard to know. Usually we won't see something like that in the acute period, but it's certainly possible to find afterwards. You know, there's probably another explanation for it. And again, this is one of those things where when you have a diagnosis of ADEM or MOG, anything after that is the first thought is, oh, this must be related. But it could be that it's just a variant. It could be caused by something else. So certainly a discussion to have with your doctor, but hard to know without knowing more information.
Thank you. I know we asked final thoughts. I don't know if you have anything else to add, but this was really great. We got through many questions and we really appreciate your time.
Of course. No, very happy to be joining with you guys. And like I said, super excited about what's to come. We've got a great community, a lot of neuroimmunologists and neurologists that care a lot about advancing this condition, all rare neuroimmunologic diseases. So it's an exciting time to be a physician, and certainly we're always out there. We're a phone call, email away if you guys need anything, and looking forward to the next couple of years.
Dr. Santoro, thank you.
Thanks so much. Bye, everyone.
Thank you, guys. Have a good day.